This is the iMoveU podcast, getting you private practice ready. We give you fresh ideas on mindset, communication, and clinical skills so you can have a fulfilled career.
What a time to be alive. Welcome to the iMoveU podcast. Pete here, and we have a very, very special guest today, the one and only, the sports physio, Adam Meekins. Welcome, my friend.
Hey, Pete. How you doing, mate?
Good, good. How are you doing today, mate?
Yeah, can't complain. It's a pretty good morning for the UK, so I can see a bit of blue sky and the sun is trying to shine through. So in England, we class that as nearly summer.
We're just coming out the tail side of summer now. I think it's 22 degrees and sunny here today, heading into winter. So
that's a heat wave in the UK, mate.
We'll watch out for that. Now, super excited to get you on the podcast, obviously, because you're probably one of the people I've looked up to the most throughout my career. And it's actually my first time getting to talk to you, but I'm a shoulder physio myself. And I started my career being very scapular, you know, dyskinesia and little scapular movements, and being fascinated by how I was a wizard and these fancy hands of mine could cure people. And then my transformation over a number of years to really go the complete opposite to that, to go simple and basic and just sticking to that and getting much, much better results. So I'd love to hear a little bit about your journey as a shoulder physiotherapist and where you sort of started and how you've got to where you are now.
Okay, mate. It's a pretty long story, so I'll try and give you the abridged version. So I think it goes back to before I was a physio. So I haven't always been a physio. My background is a little bit checkered. I come from a military background, first of all. So I did a few years when I left school and went into the military. That taught me a lot. That taught me a lot about being critical, skeptical, taught me a lot about how to swear quite colorfully as well. But, you know, I was always taught as a junior officer in the army to, you know, always analyze and critically think about the orders you're receiving before you act on them. And so I was always taught that from a young age to, you know, just receive information, but always analyze it, think about it, always have a plan B and a plan C and a plan D, because very, very rarely does plan A go according to plan. So I think that's where my critical thinking, analyzing skills were developed from a young age. When I left the army for various different reasons, then I went into my first degree was in sports science. So I went into strength and conditioning. I became a accredited strength and conditioning coach for a couple of years.
Love it.
And I was very much taught as a sports scientist, strength and conditioning coach. Again, just the basic foundational compound movements of exercise at getting people strong and robust. And I started to see the benefits in doing that. But then I came across, obviously, people with injuries. Clients, athletes of mine were having pain or having injuries. And obviously, with my background, I didn't know whether it was safe to carry on training, to carry on getting them going. So I wanted to learn a bit more of that. And that's what eventually led me into doing a second degree in physiotherapy. And I'll be honest, when I went in as a mature student now, because I was getting on a bit now in time, I went in there and I was very surprised. I went in, I think, with a little bit of rose-tinted spectacles. I thought physios were going to be the experts of movement, exercise, physiology. And very much quickly on into my training, I realized, hold on a minute, this is not what I was expecting at all. I was doing practical sessions where I was trying to feel pelvises move by 2 millimeters. There was lots of teaching about how to fit a stick, you know, and a crutch, which is important, but you don't need a 2-hour fucking practical on it. You could teach. I was sitting here for thinking, why are we still talking about this? Okay, you've got the points across. I know the key things now. Why are we still practicing it? And I don't need to come back next week to practice this. When's the next practical on squatting? When's the next practical on picking heavy things up? When's the next, you know, session on exercise physiology and muscle adaption and responses and everything like that? And it never came. The syllabus, it just never came. It was just very much, you know, focusing on the hands-on manual therapy stuff. So I was always skeptical from an early age in my career, in my training. But I thought I'd give it a go because, you know, you just get that group mentality. I always found it quite hard. As much as I am quite a vocal critic and I don't mind putting my hand up and saying, hold on a minute, I think this is bullshit. It's very hard to do that when you're a young junior physiotherapist, particularly when everybody else is around you going, Oh, yeah, 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 I agree. And you're now the black sheep. You're the only one there. So I sort of wound, you know, in the early days, I wasn't as vocal as I am now. I did a little bit, but I very much sort of just towed the party line and thought, right, I'll give it a go. I'll see how we go with this manual therapy.
Yeah.
So I was taught, you know, you've got to try and palpate imbalances. You've got to be able to find, you know, the adverse pathology using the sensations of feeling, find these gristly trigger points, find out things that are out of position and all this sort of stuff. And I tried and I went on numerous courses for years after as a junior physio, probably for 3-4 years, I kept going on course after course after course, postgraduate course, myofascial release, Swedish massage, muscle imbalances, manipulations, mobilizations with movement, nags, snags, acupuncture, dry needling, kinesio taping, sports taping. I went on all these courses because I thought, you know, the more skills I got, the better I'm going to be. And it just ended up confusing the hell out of me, started causing me more problems than I think it was actually helping. And so, you know, over a period again of a couple of years, I slowly phased everything out and just went back to basics, much to the annoyance of everybody around me, much to the disagreement with my seniors and my managers. But fuck it, I found it again. It just started to make my life easier. And I started to notice the benefits, you know, hugely in the patients that I was seeing. One, they weren't looking at me like I was some sort of alien when I started to tell them some very long-winded, highly complicated diagnosis that we think we have to give somebody because that's what the patient wants. Most of the time when I started doing that, you could see the patients going, what the fuck are you on about? You know, that doesn't make any sense at all. Like, oh, no, it is. It's because I'm the physio, I'm the expert. I know this is the way, this is what's happening. But once I started just being a bit more open, honest and rational with patients and said, look, there's nothing here to be overly concerned or worried about. We haven't got, you know, the clear diagnosis because it's a bit iffy about exactly what's going on here. But, you know, the good news is we can work on this. We know they can get better with time, patience and persistence. We've got to look at things around that you can try and help maximize your improvements and your recovery and just take a more holistic approach. I think that's the key aspect as well, is that I very much now just stopped focusing on the biology and the biomechanics. That's not to say it isn't important. That's not to say you don't focus on that, but just step back a bit and look at the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. Look at the shape of the individual rather than just the shape of their painful area, their shoulder, their back, their pelvis, their knee or whatever. What type of person is this? What are their beliefs? What are their attitudes? What's their lifestyle? What's their behaviors, etc.? All these things hugely over the years have started to help me get patients better rather than just focusing on scapular imbalances, etc. So that's a long-winded. It wasn't very short in the end, was it? It was quite long-winded.
No, it was good though. It was good. I think it gives people who may not know that about you a really good background into how you to where you are now. And look, judging by the course that you run, which is quite famous here in Australia, and a lot of people talk about it, about the shoulder.
That's
complex.
Good to hear.
Isn't too complex. is how did you sort of get into shoulders? Like, what is it about shoulders that sort of has your interest?
It was a complete accident, mate. So I was very, and again, I still feel a bit awkward saying, you know, I'm a shoulder physio because I don't actually class myself as a shoulder physio. It's almost like when I advertise myself as the sports physio, I don't really advertise myself. I would think of myself as just a sports physio. I am just a physio. You know, I see people with pain and problems, regardless of where that is. It just happens that I now work a lot more in the upper limb than I do with back pain and knee pain, but I'm still happy to see anybody with any type of problem. And it doesn't have to be a sports related issue either now. You know, I use that title when I started up my social media profile because I was working in professional sports at the time, but I left that quite shortly after I started the profile. But, you know, I have had experience of working with sports. I like working with sports injuries, but I don't only just see sports injuries. So, again, it wasn't a complete accident, mate. I got into the shoulder because a couple of shoulder consultants at the hospital I was working with wanted a designated physio that they could trust, that they could train up to do their quite complicated post-operative surgical cases that they see. So they came down and they asked me, and I refused, first of all. I said no, because I was more interested in lower limb stuff. I love an ACL rehab, you know, I love all that sort of stuff as well. And I was like, nah, shoulders, nah. But they said they did convince me, and I thought, and I've got a lot to thank these two surgeons. You know, they're quite well-known, respected surgeons in the UK. And they did teach me a lot about, you know, shoulders and, you know, their aspects and their views of what's going on from an orthopedic surgical point of view, which, you know, over the years, there's a lot of disagreement and lots of things now that I probably wouldn't agree with what they was telling me and teaching me. But I've got a lot to thank them for. They upskilled me in hugely in my knowledge in an area of shoulders. And I started obviously working a lot more with shoulders. Mm. And over the last sort of 10 years, you know, I'd say probably about 75% of my caseload now is pretty much in and around the shoulder. And yeah, that's how I got into it. But I just found myself getting, again, like I did with my physio undergraduate training, getting more and more confused, more and more, you know, more and more difference of opinions and methods about how to assess it, etc. And I found myself again going on all these shoulder specialist courses and coming away going, fucking hell, I'm even more confused than I was in the beginning. And I really did a couple of years ago get much, you know, this sort of paralysis by analysis. I had so much information, so many difference of opinions, so many different ways of assessing all this different research that I was reading. I was like, I just really don't know what to do. I was like a rabbit in the headlights now. I was like, I'm paralyzed. And that's what very much said, right, go back to your basics. Okay, just think about what is the key things to focus on. And so I came up with this simplification procedure for the shoulder. So, and I thought, you know, and I started telling a few peers about it and they go, that's a great idea. You should get that out there. You should start teaching it. And that's how it started.
That's brilliant, honestly. And I also have noticed on your Instagram, you're no longer the sports physio, you're the stay at the fuck at home physio.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest message I think I need to get out there at the moment. Yeah, just stay the fuck at home, people. If you don't need to go out, fucking don't go out, please. Please, and wash your hands a lot. And just this current COVID crisis that we're in at the moment, mate, that has very much changed the perspectives on obviously of what we've got to be focusing on as healthcare professionals now.
Mm-hmm. And look, I'll get into that stuff in a second because I'd love to talk about the telehealth and how you've made that transition and how I can help other young health professionals to make that transition too, because it is very topical. There are a lot of people very scared and that's okay. I understand that because all of their training so far has told them that without their hands, they're nothing, right?
Yeah.
Just on the shoulder stuff you did. So you said you did a lot of courses and you sort of felt like you were a deer in the headlights type thing. And it was hard and you sort of had to eventually cut through the bullshit. And I found I've gone on a very similar sort of journey of trying to be very, very specific and search for that missing tool when someone wasn't getting better. Like, what was it about me and what were my hands not able to do? What technique did I not have to help this person? And I remember just sort of like going home at night and staying up and going, wow, like what am I missing? And I'd send them to a more experienced physio who would do the exact same thing, but get a much better result. And most likely because of their confidence or how they delivered it, or even the fact that they were just older and the person looked at them and went, oh, they must be better because they're older. And there's all these other factors. And even, you know, it was probably 3 years into my career before I started asking people about their stress, their work, their sleep, their smoking, their alcohol, like all these important things that I'd never even thought of. Yeah. What would be a few tips you would give to young health professionals to sort of move away from technique and missing a technique, but what other things would you focus on in their life?
I often tell young physios, junior physios, is I think the biggest thing I try to get across to them is hold your nerve. You know, don't panic when things don't make sudden improvements or changes. Again, I see physios panicking a lot about that because they get led to believe and trained to believe they've got to reduce pain quickly, fast, and immediately sometimes, you know, within session changes. A patient walks into your room, you do your magic, they walk out jumping and springing around and feeling 100% better. That very, 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 very rarely happens, all right? Very rarely happens. And that's perfectly normal and that's perfectly okay. You are not a failure just because somebody doesn't feel suddenly less pain immediately after you've done some magic on them. Yeah. I actually think now we are probably going the wrong way as healthcare professionals by constantly over-reducing and over-emphasizing the need to reduce or remove pain in people when it's unnecessary. I think our role is different. Our role for a lot of people coming in with pain is to advise and reassure them that this pain is safe. It's not dangerous. It has one of my favorite terms. It has a favorable natural history. This shit will get better with time. We need to give them some prognosis of how long that time's going to take. They need to be reassured it'll be a bit of a rocky road. There's going to be some ups and downs. And then we need to give them some advice and reassurance of things that they can do to carry on, to modify their activities a bit whilst they've still got this pain. And also look at the other factors that can help improve the speed of their recovery a little bit by looking, as you say, at the behavioral lifestyle factors around it as well, and just keep them moving. I think, you know, that is the factor that we need to be focusing on more, rather than trying to get this short-term temporary reduction in pain that's very unreliable and often just tends to waste time, distract patients, confuse patients, rather than just being a bit more honest and simplistic to say, there's a little bit of shoulder pain here, we've done the assessment, it's okay, there's nothing serious. I think this is on average takes about 3 to 6 months to get better. All right. It ain't going to change overnight. I can't get rid of it next week. That competition that you wanted to play in 3 weeks time probably isn't going to happen. I know. I'm sorry. Okay. But it's just the way of the world. All right. Life will go on. All right. You'll be able to do it next year. Let's just focus on what we can do in this current situation now. Let me help you out. Let me guide you. Let me motivate you. Let me plan for you. Let me just be a shoulder to fucking cry on if you need to. That's what a good physiotherapist job is now at the moment, mate. We don't have to say judge our success by making people feel immediately better. So I think that's the biggest bit of advice I give junior physios.
No, I love that. I think that's perfect and probably a good segue in a minute going to the telehealth and or online consults and how that's going to work. I hate the word telehealth, actually. It sounds
like a call center. It sounds like some cheesy call center or some cold marketing sales scam.
Yeah.
Hello, this is your telehealth consultant calling. The fuck? Get out of here.
I like the term online physiotherapy because I think that it's just physiotherapy, but online.
It's an online consultation. You know, I think us physios, we undervalue our consultations. You know, consultants are called consultants for a reason, you know, because they consult. But that's exactly what we do. We consult as well. So I think we should just say, you know, this is an online consultation. Not online physio, again, because sometimes physio is misinterpreted as a technique or an intervention rather than a profession.
It's good. I like that. It's a good distinction. Now, just to touch on professional sport, because you said you worked in there for a while. How did you, because I have done a bit of work in professional sport before, and they are super like, I just need this rubbed, I just need this done. How did you go in that environment? Because they can be very, just for them, it seems to be much more the mindset of, if someone touches my quad, I'm going to perform better type thing.
Yep. So again, sport, professional sports or semi-professional sports or elite level sports, you know, it's a unique environment to work in. First things to first is they've got more time. They've got more money for all these superfluous fluffy stuffs around the edges. Okay. So again, you know, I always try to make that distinction, you know, when I'm educating, you know, are we talking about sports population who have the time, the money and the, you know, the benefit or the whatever to use these things versus people that don't. But yeah, you're right. Sports, again, a lot of athletes are, you know, very superstitious. You know, they have to have their lucky pants on. They have to have the right socks on at the right time. They have to have the right type of strapping. It has to be done by a certain physio. You know, when I worked for a football club, it was very much, okay, I'm going to go and sit. You know, there's a team of physios, but these athletes, these football players very much had their preferred physio that they liked, they interacted with, or they just felt they did the right thing and they had a good game. Therefore, they're going to get a good game again if they go back and see that physio for the pre-match rubdown. So it's, yeah, you just have to recognize in sports, that's the culture. Do I agree with it fully? No. I think, again, a lot of the stuff that happens in sports, I think, actually takes away an athlete's resilience and robustness. You know, everybody talks about focusing on improving their performance. Well, how about the other side of the coin? How about their resilience? How about their robustness? Are we looking to improve that? And I think a lot of what physiotherapy does under the guise of treatment sometimes is just reducing an athlete's robustness and resilience. I had a couple of situations where one of the squad's physio medical team couldn't make it to a game because of illness. And you saw the athlete panicking and worrying and going, my physio's not here. Oh my God, what am I going to do? And I'm like, dude, what the fuck are you worrying about this for? You've got to go out there and perform in front of thousands of people. All right. You don't want to be worrying and fucking thinking about my physio's not here. I'm not going to get the same treatment. Therefore, my performance is going to be affected. When I started to see that happening, I very much went to the gaffer and I said, you know, gaffer, look, I think this is getting the wrong way now. I think our lads are unfortunately becoming a little bit reliant and dependent on stuff. And I think it's having a knock-on effect to their performance, probably when they can't get it for whatever reasons. Unfortunately, the gaffer was a little bit, fuck it, mate. You know, if you want to tickle their left bollock and it makes them run around a bit more, you tickle their left bollock, mate. That was his sort of attitude towards that. So again, you know, it depends on the environment and obviously your bosses and your managers and everything along those lines as to how much you'll be able to influence or change that stuff. I found I wasn't able to much at all.
Yeah, and look, that's fair. I think that it's a really good point looking at the resilience side of it. Probably not something I'd thought of too much. Look, in my time working with elite athletes, it was, if this is going to help them perform better in their, with their mind, I know, and they know I'm not doing anything, but in their head, they're just like, if this happens, then that can happen.
I get this with kinesio tape a lot. Yeah. Athletes love kinesio tape. They fucking love it. All right. And when I first started using it many, many years ago, I thought, oh, this is quite unique. This is quite a good idea. This feels good. I'd used it myself and thought, oh, that's a bit different. So I quite enjoyed it to begin with, but I now see athletes again get very dependent, very, you know, I've got to have this particular type of taping. It's got to be done in the right way. It's got to be the right color and all that other shit. But then I start saying to athletes, I say, what do you think you're doing? Particularly if you're taping an area that's exposed, what are you doing to your opponent? You're basically painting a target on yourself. You're allowing your opponent to see where your weaknesses lie. So I think, again, you just got to always consider, what am I doing here? Risks and, you know, benefits, you know, and I think with taping, you know, yeah, there are some benefits, but there are also some, you know, negatives. And one of them is you're highlighting your weaknesses, particularly in a game or competition environment. And that ain't good. That ain't good.
No, exactly. I think you love this one just really quickly. When I was working with football, like AFL, Australian Rules Football, there was this one player and he was a mummy when he went out there. He had all kinds of tape. He wasn't a great player, but he just needed a lot of tape to just mentally get out there. This one time he comes in, he goes, my back is so sore, like it's out of place, all these kinds of things. And I tried all kinds of explaining that your spine doesn't move out of place. You haven't been in a car crash, have you? No, you're all good. It's fine. And he's like, you just need to do something. So I get this one piece of kinesio tape and I can look at his back and I'm like, bang, close my eyes and just chuck it on there. Yeah, there's no tension on it. And I'm like, this is going to be perfect. This is exact, like, trust me, this is going to be amazing. He goes out, plays the best game of his life, comes back and says how brilliant this tape was. And every time he got it done thereafter, we'd randomly put it somewhere and we'd laugh at it. Like, it was bloody hilarious. And this one game that I wasn't there, someone else randomly put it on. And the next time I see him, he's like, he just can't tape like you, Peter.
But then again, that just highlights beautifully how our therapeutic alliance, the act of treatment, is probably doing more than we probably give credit for. We make people feel better because of other things than the treatments we do. We make people feel better because they trust us, they like us, et cetera, along those lines. And I tell physios, you know, recognize that and try to maximize that. Everyone says, well, but then that's the placebo effect. You know, I'm like, no, that's a contextual effect, different from the placebo effect. You know, just maximize it. If you can connect with a patient and they trust you and like, you're fucking good, great, you know, use it to your advantage to try to get them to focus on things that really, really matter.
Yeah, absolutely. If someone likes and trusts you, you're much more likely to have a good effect on them mentally and be able to change.
It's the only way I find that I get patients not to do stupid things. To stop doing stuff, you know. Everyone says, well, how do you get somebody that's been seeing a chiropractor for 33 years to stop going to see that chiropractor? And I said, only if they like me, all right? They're only going to listen to my advice and follow my advice if they trust and like me. So I've got to very much find that connection with a patient on the first assessment quite quickly. And that is the skill of being a good physiotherapist. It's not on this hands-on shit. It's about your communication. It's about your interaction skills. It's being a chameleon and being able to, you know, connect with an 80-year-old Mrs. Ethel Meggins, okay, versus Steve, your scaffolder, who likes a few beers and bevvies down the pub. You know, you've got to interact differently with all these different types of people. That is the skill, that is the key to all that we do.
I couldn't agree more with you. And I run an entire course here in Australia on communication in healthcare and how building rapport as fast as possible is going to be the next big advancement I see in physiotherapy.
I touch on it at the beginning of my course. So the first hour's lecture is focusing on these things. And I very much say, before we start talking about rotator cuffs and stuff, I just want to point out how important this shit is. And I reckon, again, you've got, the first time you meet a patient, I reckon you've got about 120 seconds, okay, to get onto the right foot, about 2 minutes, all right? So those first initial couple of minutes with a patient are so fucking vital. And they're the bits that physios just sometimes flippantly don't recognize. They'll go out into the waiting room. I can understand it, end of a long week, you know, picking their nose, looking drawn and fucking disheveled, tired, etc. And if you meet a patient looking like that, boom, they are going to, who's this idiot? Okay, who the fuck are they going to help me out? Okay. Now, again, you just got to play the game. Just, you know, keep your appearance as good as you possibly can. Find that good connection and fit with a patient, but do it very, very quickly on, because it's very hard to turn it around. If you piss a patient off or a patient doesn't like the look of you within a couple of minutes, good luck trying to get that patient to do anything you want, and good luck in trying to get them to feel better in a few months' time.
No, I love that. And for everyone listening, put more respect into developing a relationship really quickly with that patient, because that will determine the results everything you do does.
Absolutely.
Now, I'd love to talk a little bit about telehealth and how you've made that transition. About online consults and how you've made that transition, because there's a lot of people doing it at the moment really poorly, and I think that that has the possibility to really ruin it for a lot of people, because if everyone says, "Ah, I went to the physio and did an online consult and it was shite," it's not going to have a good effect on the rest of us. So how have you managed that so far, and what would you say is different and what's the same? And I'm really interested because I don't think there's going to be much difference for you.
No, you're right there, mate. I think everything that makes a successful face-to-face consultation is going to make a successful online consultation. Obviously, there's clearly some things we can't do on an online consultation versus a face-to-face consultation, and the main one is touching them. That really is about the only thing we can't do. That's the only difference. Yeah. That's the bit that stresses and worries out the physios the most. And I'm like, but that's just a tiny, tiny part of everything else we do. You know, a very, very small part. And to be honest, it's a part that isn't that important in some circumstances. In fact, in most circumstances. So focus on the 99% of the things that you can still do in an online consultation that can still help somebody, and don't just worry and panic about the 1% that you can't do. So yeah, I think online consultations are sometimes sillily misunderstood as being second best or inferior to face-to-face consultations. Yeah. And I totally disagree with that. Online consultations have some amazing benefits and, you know, can open up some great new opportunities and windows for physiotherapists. I think, ironically, you know that term manual therapists like to use, the window of opportunity?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to do this little dry needling technique and open up a window of opportunity of less pain so you can do your exercises better. I fucking hate that term because it's used so much just to justify a physiotherapist's bullshit treatment.
Yeah. But
I think, ironically, the window of opportunity now couldn't be any more fitting for physiotherapy, because it's these bloody windows of opportunity. It's our PC, our laptop windows of opportunity. Mm. But they are not second best. They are not inferior to face-to-face consultations. I've been doing them for years. Pretty much my whole private practice is all online. Very, very rarely do I see a private client now face-to-face. The only clients I see face-to-face are my NHS patients in my ESP role that I do there. So all my private work now is pretty much, in fact, 99.9% online consultations. One, because now I have a very small area to work in. I don't have any premises anymore. Focusing on my online work and teaching, and obviously my NHS role, I work in the NHS, so they can't come and see me privately there anyway. But yeah, I've been doing them for years and find to say they take a while. You know, it does take a while to get. I think the hardest thing is the technical aspect of it. You know, it's not so much, you know, if you're a good physio face-to-face, you're probably going to be a good physio on online consultations. But it is the, you know, setting up the systems, it's getting a sort of a nice systemized process going, getting the booking systems going, getting, you know, the payment options going, etc. That for me was probably the hardest bit, getting all that, you know, stacked up in the right order. That took a few months to get right. But once it's there, it's there. You know, you can start to get patients to book in automatically. You get the slots opened up on your diary, patients book in, work out a payment system. Do they pay before or afterwards? Okay, give them some information, you know, confirmation emails that has some, you know, what to expect, preempts patients' expectations. Because again, I find, you know, this is a new experience for a lot of people. A lot of patients haven't done this before. So they might be feeling a bit anxious and worried and don't know what to expect. So I give them all that information up front and say, look, this is what's going to happen. Make sure you're in a, you know, private area. You can't do an online consultation at work with your mates walking behind you, all right? Can't do it whilst you're out in the shopping supermarket, which I've had before. I've had a patient think that they can have an online consultation whilst they're walking around fucking the Sainsbury's in the supermarket. I'm like, no, this is not good. I need to have a look at the area that you're going to be complaining about. I'm going to have to have a video. I'm going to have to ask you to take your top off, probably. You need to be somewhere suitable to do that. So from that experience, I've learned, tell the patients that, because they just sometimes don't understand that's probably what's going to happen. So this sort of, again, getting all this sort of lined up in, you know, emails and information that you send to the patient just makes the whole process a lot more systemized, a lot more streamlined. And then again, like I said, you just focus on the things you can do, interact with your patient, connection, get a bit of, you know, banter going if you can. Obviously, take a full history, look into their lifestyle, do your objective examination as best as you can do, which is where I find laptops are quite beneficial because you can tilt the screens up and down. You know, it's stable enough, hopefully, that they know it's not on a phone, it's not going to wobble around too much. Look at range of movement, maybe ask them to have a few weights or something around in the background that they can try to lift or pull something up so you can compare painful side versus non-painful side. How much strength, how much endurance has it got? They're the key things to focus on. Your little special tests, all right? Your little palpation tests. Very, very rarely are they going to give you any further information than just doing the basics really well will do. And then go from there.
I love that. I love that. And in my head right now, I'm just picturing someone go, all right, now I want you to do an empty can test on yourself.
Oh, no. It's like, why do you need to do that? If you, again, you take a good history, you do the basic examination, observe the area, check the range of movement, do a couple of little resisted tests, you know, that they can do themselves using some, you know, bottles of water, can of food, bags with some apples or spuds in it or something, you know, that is going to give you 99% of the information you need. You know, you can't do neural screening. Very good. Okay. You can ask patients the subjective questions around neural deficits, but you can't do, you know, true objective neural testing. So that's a limitation. But if you've got any clues in the subjective that there may be a neural element in there, you're going to keep a closer eye on them. You're just going to make sure that there is no deterioration of those symptoms or any worsening of those symptoms. If somebody has some really frank, gross, obvious, clear as day neurological signs, your objective tests probably weren't going to give you any more further information than what they've already told you. So if you've got that, then you're going to start the pathway of taking them on down to, you know, further care and urgent treatment if needs be. But that very rarely is going to be a serious, hopefully serious issue that we're going to see a lot. But, you know, you can, again, when it comes to serious and sinister things, red flags, neuro type issues, the key is in the history. The patients, what they tell you, will give you the index of suspicion that there's something serious and sinister going on here. Your little tests around that very rarely are going to increase that sensitivity or specificity of what the history is telling you.
And that's where I think this is going to get really exciting moving forwards, right, is when you take everyone's hands away and they can't do tests and they can't do objective, they can't do their normal treatment, they're going to have to get really, oh, sorry, they, we, I'll say, I'll put myself in that boat too, because I'll improve that too. Is we're going to have to get so much better at our subjective, at developing rapport, at getting an amazing history, because now we have to, because you take away one thing and everything else has to improve. So when this is all over in 6, 12, 18, you know, 6 years if you're in America, we're going to be better therapists for it. And
absolutely, yeah.
You'll be able to, you can put your manual therapies back in, you can put your favorite things back in, but everything else will get better. And that's what I think is really exciting for a lot of young therapists that are a little bit scared at the moment, a little bit fearful, is that this is going to make you an incredible therapist. And we've had a new grad who's just started with us, and I'm super excited for him, because I wish I had this opportunity when I was at the start of my career, because it would have actually fast-tracked my development by a long way. So
absolutely. I sometimes, you know, use the same explanation as I do sometimes when I used to work in stroke, when I worked in stroke patients and they had, you know, hemiparesis and semiparalysis of one side of their arm. I used to, you know, do the restraint treatment. I used to say, right, your good arm, I'm not going to allow you to use. All right. We're going to strap that down for a few hours. All right. It's going to force you to try and use your paralyzed arm. It's going to try and force you to focus on the things that you can't do. And guess what? It started to improve when they didn't keep relying on the things they can do and now had to focus on these sort of things that they found harder, and they used the other skill, they improved in it. And I think that's no different with our online consultations. Now that your hands are tied behind your back, now you've got to, okay, improve your skills in other areas. So like you said, it's going to be a massive opportunity. I just hope it does continue on. When things do hopefully go back to normal soon, I just hope physios just recognize a lot more that these other things are superfluous. They are fluffy, unnecessary little things around what we do. Focus on the stuff that really matters.
Absolutely. And not only that, but myself as a business owner, looking at what this is going to do to the physiotherapy profession or allied health in general, is it, you know, everyone these days wants flexible working arrangements. Being amazing at online consults could give you a day or two of working from home, and like, I think that's bloody exciting.
who doesn't like to sit in their underpants? Because at the moment, that's exactly what I'm doing, mate. You wouldn't know it, but you know, I'm all business up top, but party underneath, mate. And who doesn't want to fancy doing that a couple of days a week? Well, that's another great benefit. And as well as reaching to a bigger audience, you know, you can start to consult not just your local community, but to a wider audience, you know, a global community.
No, I completely agree. Like, you can be treating people from wherever, really, as long as you build your reputation within that. And to me, probably the other really exciting thing about online consultations is going to be people with chronic pain. I actually think online consults are better for chronic pain than in person, because it means you can't get them dependent on you with manual therapy, right?
Yeah, good point. I also think, again, doing it in their sort of own environment, again, allows us that little window into their lifestyles. We can see what's the environment that you're struggling with these certain tasks or activities, rather than a room or a cubicle in a physio department. Now we're looking at the patient in their front room, all right? And they're saying, well, it's as I've got to do this, and that's where I get problems. And then we can sort of see that in real time. And that's going to give us a great bit of information.
Exactly. And whatever you prescribe for them at home, you can see what they have available. You can get them to do it in front of you, and they got no bloody excuse not to.
Absolutely. And you can even record things as well. So, you know, it's like we're doing, you record the consultation, you can edit snippets of it. You can send them that to say, look, this is what I want you to do. Well, I've forgotten what to do. Well, there's a video of it. Okay. There's a video of you doing it. Okay. It's exactly what I want you to do. So yeah, lots and lots of opportunities with online consults.
Beautiful, beautiful. Now look, you've actually got a course coming up the end of April, don't you?
Yeah, my I've had to again adapt what I normally do with my teaching. So my course obviously is normally face to face, but with this current COVID shit show going on, obviously the sociable, sensible thing to do is maintain physical distance until we get the all clear that we can start engaging with humans again. Well, some humans anyway. I don't want to engage with every human. But when we can start engaging again physically with people, then I'm going to go back to face-to-face. But I thought I had to adapt. So I've now decided to do a live online course. So it's going to be like my face-to-face course. It's not a recorded version. So there will be opportunities for people to interact and stuff. So it's going to be done across Zoom as a webinar. I'm going to be talking. I'm going to be presenting my slides. People could throw questions up as and when they need to. And I've been blown away at the response to that. I thought, you know, in this time with people focusing on things other than obviously shoulder pain, I didn't think it would be that popular, but it's sold out already. So I've been got a waiting list, and I'm going to have to release another one in May. So keep an eye out for that. I'll be publish another one. The only downside, it will be in UK time. So I'm not going to do it at stupid o'clock, whatever time it is down there in Australia land. So it will be UK time only thing.
That's all right. I think, you know, we can just have a few beers and stay up a bit later. I got no problems with that. It sounds like a great evening to me, actually, mate. There's not many courses I've been to where you can drink beers throughout and just relax at home in your undies.
Again, another great benefit of online education. Exactly. Your own home, you can mute the mic, you can interact as much or as little as you want. It's not one of those courses where you have to pretend to be paying attention in the back of the course when you don't really want to. You can actually go and have a lie down if you want.
So April sold out, you said?
Yeah, already. So, I mean, I could open more spaces because obviously it's a virtual space, but I just wanted to not give people the opportunity to ask questions, etc. So I limited to a certain number just so it's more manageable for me and for and people coming onto it. So, yeah, it's sold out. So I'm going to do another one in May, and then obviously we'll see going forward from there what's going to be happening. But the fact I've had a good response to it, I might do it a little bit more often in the future.
Yeah, look, I've actually had a few people I know that have said, oh, this is online, this is awesome, because they couldn't make it to the ones you did in Australia. So it could be a really awesome thing. So I'll let them know about the ones in May, my friend.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Awesome. All right. And for our viewers and listeners, we're going to put this on YouTube as well. Where can they find you online?
So I'm across all the social media platforms nowadays. I've even developed a little bit of a fetish for TikTok. So I've sort of dipped my toe into TikTok. I know it's not that I post much on there. I'm just sitting there with my mouth open going, what the fuck's going on there? So TikTok's quite interesting platform. So I'm on TikTok, but the main ones that I'm on are the main platforms. So I'm on there, Twitter, so at Adam Meekins, or you can just look at the Sports Physio. That tends to find me as well. Facebook as well, Adam Meekins or the Sports Physio. Instagram as well, I'm on there. The only thing I'd say that I'm not on, obviously, are other things like Tinder or Grindr or anything along those lines. So if you find an Adam Eakins on there, that's not me.
Oh, brilliant. Well, look, thank you so much for joining us for this podcast, mate. It has been an absolute pleasure having you, and we hope to see you down under again soon.
Yeah, hopefully, mate. Plans maybe for early 2021. So I'm in negotiations with a few people to try and get me down to do a couple more courses there. Hopefully sort of February, March time, 2021.
Hopefully we can travel then.
Yeah, hopefully. The airs will open and the viruses will be a thing of the past, hopefully. Until COVID 2021. Don't say that. No, but thanks for it's been an enjoyable chat, Pete. Thanks very much, mate.
Beautiful. What a time to be alive. The iMove You podcast.
This is the iMove You podcast, getting you private practice ready. We give you fresh ideas on mindset, communication, and clinical skills so you can have a fulfilled career.